This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, writer John Higgs helps us to make sense of the 20th century in his book, Stranger Than We Can Imagine. John Higgs is the author of I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary, The KLF, Chaos Magic and the Band Who Burned £1 Million, and the novel The Brandy and the Damned. His latest book is Stranger Than We Can Imagine, Making Sense of the 20th Century, which is what we're going to be talking about today. John, thank you very much for joining me on Little Atoms.
Hello, Neil.
This book, what is it about? What's the idea?
About the 20th century. The basic idea, to try and distill it down, is the notion that we're all very comfortable with all the great discoveries and innovations of history up until about the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Anything up till then, you know, electricity, photography, agriculture, makes sense to us. You know, we might not
understand it.
We might not be able to build a steam engine, but there's nothing about the existence of steam engine that fills us with existential dread. You know, we're comfortable with it. But then you hit the 20th century and you immediately get Einstein and relativity and cubism and modernism and existentialism and quantum mechanics and postmodernism and chaos mathematics and psychedelia and everything that was new, everything that was radical, everything that was a great innovation of the 20th century is just so off-putting and disturbing. And the natural temptation is to go, ooh, Jesus, that's not for me.
Yeah.
I'll just step back. I don't really need to know about that. I'll catch up later when it gets a bit clearer. Which is totally understandable, but it does mean that we're here in the 21st century looking at it with 19th century eyes and thinking, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense. We do need to take on board what we discovered in the 20th century, and this is what this book is about.
Well, we'll come back in a second to talk about what perhaps happened at the, you know, the dawn of the 20th century, what happened to the human psyche that made those changes happen. But before we do that, why did you think it was a good idea to write this book? Why did you want to take this rather colossal task on?
Yeah, you know, the 20th century was the period of time that made me. You know, it's the context for at least the first half of my life. So I felt like I should understand it. And the books I'd written before, I'd written about Timothy Leary, I'd written about the KLF, and every time I was doing those, they sort of revealed to me the wider context of the times were far stranger than I understood. Things like the Timothy Leary story, I was writing about psychedelia, the 60s, the 70s. I had no idea that that led directly into the personal computer revolution.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that Silicon Valley is where it is, due to the vast amount of, you know, psychedelics that were being taken there just a few years before. I didn't realise that whole psychedelic scene came out of, you know, the beat writers and things like that. It was all more interconnected. So the notion of getting your head around the 20th century seemed more and more valuable the more I sort of wrote about these things. And it's like 2015 now, you know.
Yeah.
We should have a good sense. But the sense of the 20th century that we tend to have is, we all know it. It's just, it starts, you know, there's the First World War, there's the Great Depression, the Second World War, the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's this, these great shifts of geopolitical power. That's the story we're told. And it's a fine story. You know, it's a clear narrative. I've nothing against it. But it doesn't seem to lead into the world we live in now.
Yeah.
And I just thought there must be another story that would help us make sense of where the hell we are at this moment. That would be more useful and valuable.
And those sort of big, weighty 20th century history books that tell you, you know, take you step by step through the great battles in the Second World War or something, or, you know, the books about the 1950s and 60s, they don't often have the, you know, the part, for instance, that Satanism played in some of those movements.
There's very little Satanism in them all. It's I've noticed that. It's surprising how many of those are written by politicians or political journalists or very politically influenced historians.
Yeah.
And they all kind of take the view that to tell the story of the 20th century, you tell the story of the politicians. as if they were the people who made that century. Now, particularly the 20th century, that really wasn't the case at all. You know, the politicians were pretty much the last to know about what was happening in the 20th century. And, you know, not a huge amount of Satanism in those books either, so fail on both counts.
So let's go back to the sort of 19th century mind. We're coming to the end of that century, and we'll talk about some of the things that might have happened. But in the book, you raise this concept. You look at a lot of the chapters through this concept of something called the omphalos. I don't know how to pronounce it. How would you pronounce it?
I pronounce it omphalos.
Okay, well, that's good. I've got that.
That'll do for me. I don't claim to be an educated man who knows the correct pronunciations of things. Let's go for omphalos.
Yeah, let's do that. So what does that mean?
It's a fixed point. Right, it's the centre of the world.
Yeah.
It's a universal constant of every culture, this notion that there is either the navel of the world or the world pillar or somewhere from which everything else makes sense. Mm-hmm. For the ancient Greece, it was Delphi. In the Delphic oracle, there was the omphalos, and the story goes that Zeus wanted to know where the centre of the world was, so he released two eagles, mm-hmm. and they flew towards each other, and they collided and fell down at Delphi, and that meant, because this is God logic, that meant that was the centre of the world. That made
really
clumsy
eagles.
Yeah, you know, but you know, Zeus was happy with that, so I'm not going to argue with him. But at the same time, in ancient Japan, for instance, Mount Fuji was the omphalos for the Sioux Indians. Yeah. It was the Black Hills. Then later, all roads led to Rome for the Roman Empires, and then Jerusalem became the centre of the world. It was constantly changing, constantly moving throughout history, this notion of what was the fixed point, the centre of the world.
Yeah.
And at the end of the 19th century, it was the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, mm-hmm. marking 0 degrees latitude. That was the centre of the world, for at least to the mind of the British Empire.
And you sort of set the scene with the anarchist guy who attempts, like, completely out of the blue and for no discernible reason that could be discerned afterwards, to blow it up.
Yeah, Marcel Boudin. He was there was a novel by Conrad, I think.
The secret agent,
based on this attempt. It was the first piece of international terrorism on British soil, I believe. A French anarchist built a bomb, thought, well, I'm in London, I've got a bomb, I think I'll go to the Greenwich Observatory. And it didn't go too well for him. It blew up a little bit too soon, killed him, never managed to explain what he was trying to do. And everyone was so utterly bewildered, because everyone was thinking, well, if I had a bomb in London, I would maybe go to, you know, the Houses of Parliament. I might go to Downing Street. I might go to Buckingham Palace. Why on earth would you go to an observatory? I mean, what is it about an observatory that is worth risking your life, you know, to destroy? And it was a big puzzle, and nobody really had an answer. It it seemed that the man was mad, as it were. But the notion of the Greenwich Observatory as the fixed point of a global system of, you know, positioning and time around the entire world. It was the fixed point of the entire global system, for want of a better word. And that seems to be what attracted Marcel Boudin to it, and that's what he wanted to, you know, he wanted to plunge his heart into the knife of the beast. It was the British Empire's omphalos.
So we're talking about the 20th century, and as often happens, this is like a sort of the cultural idea of the 20th century rather than something that starts, you know, on the eve of whatever, 1901, and ends up in, you know, in the year 2000, whichever we got, you know, one of those, we got the millennium wrong. Let's just skip forward a few years to 1905, which I guess is the point where the first chapter that you talk about
with Einstein.
In this book is Einstein.
Yeah. I mean, that's the obvious place to start. I mean, that's where, you know, I view this story. I mean, 100 years is obviously an arbitrary time period, and historians know this. And hence they write things like the long 19th century, which I think goes from 1780-something to 1914, or the short 20th century. They don't really stick with the 100 years. Mm. But for my purposes, 20th century is fine, because it was from when things stopped making sense to where we are now. That was what I was interested in. And right at the start, there comes Einstein and relativity, which is probably the most, for most people, incomprehensible, bewildering, sort of off-putting advances in the physical sciences. Mm. It's over 100 years, and most people haven't got a damn clue what the hell it's about. It's explained so badly to people. But at the core of it is this idea that these omphalosses that I was talking about, these fixed points, are entirely arbitrary, mm-hmm. and don't actually exist in the real world. They're just things we mentally project onto it. For all that people would, the rest of the world agreed that Greenwich Mean Time was the fixed point in the centre of the world, there was a big international meeting in the 19th century, and all the countries came together, and it was a foregone conclusion because America was using GMT, and I think 72% of the world's shipping maps were using mm-hmm. the Meridian Line, so it was always going to happen. Yeah. But it wasn't universal.
Yeah.
You know, the French, right, they abstained. Right. For the French, the centre of the universe, the centre of France, is this point called Point Zero, which is, if you go to Notre Dame, it's just in front of Notre Dame in the pavement. There's this little plaque, this little star. For them, that's the centre of the French world. And it brings home the point that these things are whatever we say they are.
Yeah.
And in science, you know, in school we were probably taught to plot the position of things using Cartesian axes, yes. X, Y and Z, with a little zero or origin, and we can work out where things are from there. What Einstein was about, essentially, was just deleting those, was just rubbing those out, because they don't actually exist. They're not actually a property of the universe itself. I mean, we're free to project any particular point as being a fixed point. You know, we're free to measure everything from wherever we like, but what we can't do, and this is what Einstein was about, we can't say any one of those points has a priority, has any special quality over all the others. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all arbitrary. And it doesn't seem much.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem such a big radical thing. But when you start looking at the physical world with that understanding, it gets very, very strange very, very quickly.
I'm Emma-Jane Unsworth, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a podcast about ideas and culture.
I mean, I guess the other event that's going to happen, and you talk about it as sort of in a separate chapter, but I want to bring it in to cover all of the... We're going to talk about modernism and then the eventual rise of individualism.
Mm.
But the thing as well that comes... We're talking about Einstein's general... Einstein's special theory of relativity at the moment. By the time he gets to come up with his general theory of relativity in EMC squared, which is the thing that, you know, most people will be familiar with,
mm.
the other thing that's going on is the First World War.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is obviously, you know, a huge cataclysmic event, but it's also something that completely destroys the existing political order as well. It changes the emphasis on how we see
Absolutely.
Power in that sort of way, isn't it?
I mean, it's almost a surprise to us now when you look back at that pre-World War I, that beginning of the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
and realise that this was a world of emperors, right? Of emperors and tsars
yeah.
and kaisers. It just seems slightly ludicrous. It seems like something out of Game of Thrones
yeah.
or something. But, you know, we had the Austro-Hungarian Empire, we had the Ottoman Empire, we had the Russian Empire, the German Empire, British Empire, Japanese Empire, Chinese Empire, and, you know, rest of the world sort of carved up by all these things. It was just the way the world had always been,
mm-hmm.
you know, since Alexander the Great, since before that. There never had been a time without this notion of having an absolute lord,
mm-hmm.
you know, an absolute master, these hierarchical structures on society. And the idea had been chipped away at over the preceding few hundred years, certainly from the English Civil War, certainly during the Enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
you know, the idea of the rise of the rights of man, of representative democracy, all these sort of things have been chipping away
at this notion.
But it still existed.
Yeah.
There were still emperors. And we were understood in that sort of know your place mindset, okay?
Yeah.
It wasn't that a person, wasn't what a person was like, whether they were a good person, a kind person, a competent person that mattered. What was important was where they were in the hierarchy. You know, it mattered if you were a serf or a general than what you were like as a person. We were just in these sort of fixed hierarchies.
Mm-hmm.
It seems ludicrous to us now. It really does. But that was the way it had always been. And there didn't seem to be any indication that it could be anywhere mm-hmm. else. And then, bam, immediately after the First World War, it's like a blink of an eye in historic terms. It's over. You know, it was the way things had always been, and it was gone. You know, the emperors were, you know, either sent into exile or, you know, in the case of the Tsar, you know, taken down into a cellar and shot with all their family, or whichever your particular preference was in these things. You know, maybe the Japanese emperor lasted till the end of the Second World War before being stripped of all their power. But in this blink of an eye, the way things had always been gone, and now that fixed point in political society. You might not have liked the way things were ordered, but you knew how they were ordered. We were all linked to that one point up above us, that emperor, our lord, you know. That was gone. And it's weird how similar it was to what Einstein was coming up with. Just this removal of this fixed point that we can orientate ourselves with just happened across all the society. It happened in art as well as politics and science. It was odd. It was like humanity just went up a gear all at once. You know, there was no obvious cause for it. It just happened. It was like... It was when, like, life came out of matter, or consciousness came out of life. It, you know, things have been going the same way for millennia, 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 and all of a sudden a different level sort of pops into play for no apparent reason. Mm-hmm. It's very, very significant, that point. Very, very radical.
I want to move us on to art and, you know, the rise of modernism, because it doesn't seem like an obvious link, but not necessarily directly. These things were obviously there in the culture that the artists were working in. But certainly to begin with, the ideas of Einstein, and then going on to the sort of quantum theorists as we get, you know, on into the sort of 30s and 40s, you can see the effect that those movements had on artistic movements as well.
Sure.
Started with modernism. So let's talk about that link in modernism, first of all.
Yeah, in fact, that was one of the first sparks that formed the book, was seeing one of Dali's pieces. In fact, it was a sculpture of a melting clock that they had at County Hall. And just looking at that little plaque underneath it and noting the date and going, oh, that was just after Einstein showed that time was not fixed but bent. Mm-hmm. And understanding it differently then, just sort of seeing that link. That seemed an obvious way that art and science were all connected. Mm-hmm. But this, again, I keep going back to this notion of removing the fixed points. And when you look at pretty much a huge, well, I mean... Modernism is a big, big subject, but, you know, wherever you look, you keep finding it. I mean, Cubism is an obvious example. Mm-hmm. Cubists, painters, it was no longer enough just to take one perspective on what they were painting. They had to look at it from a whole bunch of different angles and go around the side and go above and see all these different things and then attempt to try and condense that down into one single image. So it was, you know, rejecting again the idea that there was one fixed point from which something could be understood. You see that in, say, atonal music, mm-hmm. Schoenberg, the Viennese sort of score, which most music is based around a central note, a central tone, and all the other notes in the composition make sense because they're based on that. You know, in Vienna, they got rid of that idea that it was this central tone, and it's left a lot of music that's still very challenging to my ear. I would say it's an idea that just, as you see it in literature, if you view the fixed point of literature as the central narrative. You know, a lot of the modernist writers were just sort of rejecting that. The idea of Joyce trying to write the city of Dublin into existence in Ulysses, trying to understand the city from every perspective, mm-hmm. by rejecting the idea of a fixed narrative from which everything makes sense for Ulysses. It's what's interesting is it's not a clear case that artists were inspired by Einstein, because if you look at a lot of the modernists, they were pursuing this idea of rejecting, you know, a fixed and favoured perspective before Einstein. It's just something that just arose simultaneously in every corner of the world and society and politics, as we say now.
With the development of film and photography as well, which, you know, the sort of new descent in the staircase being the sort of obvious case. Oh. But this also works on a number of levels as well, because in the book you talk about, you know, what has become an incredibly famous incident, the premiere of The Rye of Spring.
Yeah.
Which... Talking about seeing things from different sort of points of view, it's barely 100 years ago, this thing happening, and yet it's a myth. It's a thing that could have been like 500 years ago, because nobody really knows what happened.
Yeah, I mean, all the more recent research has gone back to find contemporary evidence of the great riot that was sparked by the premiere of The Rite of Spring, and there isn't any. The police records have mysteriously disappeared and things like that. But in the newspapers and journals of the time, no mention of this mythic riot. It seems to be a story that's attached itself over time. Which is kind of interesting in itself, because the myths need something to form around. You know, that not every single badly received premiere gets a myth, a myth of a huge riot. You know, there's something about the music of the right swing that deserves it. You know, you listen to it, you go, yeah, I'd make a myth of a riot around that. You know, that makes a lot of sense. But again, you know, the right swing's got all these polyrhythms, these sort of clashing rhythms, refusing to accept just one perspective, just throwing a whole bunch of different ones together. It's a similar idea, but that's one of its wildest and most one of its most exciting expressions, I think. It's great.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to John Higgs, and we're talking about his book Stranger Than We Can Imagine, Making Sense of the 20th Century. And John, in the second part, I want to concentrate on, go really inward and look at ourselves. Yeah. We're talking about some sort of movement in science and art, but I want to talk about the changes to our, you know, to the human psyche, to psychology and to our sex lives and to, you know, things like existentialism and nihilism perhaps. But specifically, let's begin with looking at the rise of the idea of individualism, which now as something from our distant vantage point seems so obvious, but really is like a relatively recent phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to what we were just talking about when we got rid of the emperors. Right, and all political power was invested in the emperors, or mostly, most of political power anyway. And once the emperors were gone, we suddenly had to share political power between ourselves with democracy. This is when we get universal suffrage. This is when people get the vote. And without that figurehead of society, the obvious, when that's been beheaded, we start to view ourselves as the central focus for understanding the world. It's slightly abstract, but it is the sort of logical result of everything we've been talking about so far, which is freeing and liberating and exciting, but at the same time isolating, because the moment you start to think of yourself as an individual, you stop thinking of yourself as part of wider groups, wider social groups. So it has this sort of darker edge to it all along, you know. And it took some coming to terms with the idea of thinking of ourselves as individuals, which is much of what the story of the 20th century was about, is kind of often a violent and dark and hard and challenging, but also exciting and thrilling and liberating story. And it's sort of, it's the 20th century in a nutshell, really.
And so let's talk about, I mean, some of the people that you choose to look at as sort of pioneers of the idea of individualism. And we can think of the whole of the 20th century is often described as the American century, and this sort of idea of sort of rugged individualism on the on the frontier and stuff is sort of an older idea in America. But then, you know, you talk about people
it's not so much, actually. You know, the myth of the West does come after the West was settled. You know, after about 1890 onwards or something like that. During the time that the cowboys were around, it didn't sort of exist. It was only after it was gone that this idea of this rugged, free individual sort of caught the public imagination. And it's interesting because there are cowboys in other parts of the world, you know, functionally similar examples of cowboys in Andalusia or, I don't know, Australia or various
Argentina
places.
Argentina,
exactly. That didn't have quite the same hold on our imaginations as the American West, the American cowboy. And it was this notion of them as free individuals with no, you know, master or lord above them that was so in tune with the times that was so appealing to people.
And that's obviously been, you know, throughout this period of time, it's been glorified in cinema. You know, the Western's become one of the most popular cinema genres. But I want to sort of get us to, Anne Rand, basically. That's sort of one of the darker manifestations of this idea.
She's very much of this tradition. I mean, I go back to someone like Aleister Crowley, who would come out and say, "Do what thou wilt," which is just the logical conclusion of individualism,
yeah.
you know, to its almost shocking extent. And Ayn Rand is very much in that tradition of the individual first is morally and intellectually the correct way to live your life, knowing full well how isolating the philosophy is. Mm-hmm. I mean, talking about cowboys, it's, I think the ultimate expression of individualism in the 20th century was the Clint Eastwood character, the Man with No Name,
in those
Sergio Leone movies. And he was so cool. He had no name, right? Mm-hmm. Because he was so isolated from the rest of society, right? He didn't need a name. That's how isolated he was. And in the 20th century, we've gone, oh, wow, he's so cool. He doesn't even have a name. You know, that's how we saw the world. Mm-hmm. The philosophy of Crowley to Ayn Rand is very much part of that similar set of ideas.
And that works very well for a individual if they are, you know, a person that's completely isolated from anybody else. But of course, as soon as 2 people or 10 people or a village or a society bash up against each other with competing individualistic needs, it becomes a bit more complicated.
That's where the problem comes in. It's the problem of the commons, as it's called. This is why we were talking about Satanism earlier, the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey. They just say, yeah, we're basically, you know, Ayn Rand, but with trappings, you know. A few more goats, basically, some horns, and Ayn Rand opponents are big on the goats. But the central idea of Satanism and Ayn Rand boils down to the same thing. She talked about wanting to form a new post-Christian form of morality centred on the self. Mm-hmm. She would talk about the virtue of selfishness. And now, to me and you think, well, that's very different to Christianity, that's very, very different to, you know, love thy neighbour as thyself or whatever. So it's always confusing when, to certain sections of the American right, Christianity and Ayn Rand seem to go together. That's very odd, certainly to Europeans to understand. That's a very, very, very weird thing.
At the same time that the sort of movement of individualism is happening, one of the things that sort of speeds that along is a growth in, you know, Freud, psychoanalysis, and well, and this idea you talk about, you know, the idea of the, you know, the id, the superego and the ego. Let's talk about that for a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it was being at the time when we'd sort of lost the notion of knowing your place, of having this master above us, that sort of went. In Freud's model, at least one of Freud's model, he had the superego and the id as these two contrasting drives, I guess is probably the right word. The superego was about obeying the laws of society and playing by the rules and being good. Mm-hmm. And the id was just about desires and impulses and just going wild and doing all the wonderful things that you want to do. And when emperors went, and that know your place thing went, the pull of the superego was no longer as strong. And then you hit the 30s, and suddenly there's this wild, the jazz age, this wild sense of liberation and sexual freedom and hedonism and all the things that Victorians were just appalled by would just sort of come into play. And you see it in the way people dressed, the dances they did. It was just suddenly so liberating and freeing than it had been before.
And then that sort of gives an explanation as well for how readily people went along with fascism, basically. It was almost like, you know, the dictatorship government saying, you know, we're the superego, we're saying, you know, we're giving you permission, we're giving you orders to go out and commit all of this terrible stuff.
That was one of those rare times where obeying what you were told by your government satisfied both your superego and that you were obeying them and your id and that you were being, you know, evil and destructive and terrible at the same time. This is the theory of the mass psychology of fascism. This is all about the mass society and controlling the mass society. When, as I say, our power had been distributed away from an emperor to a democratic society, people who were still in charge of the society had to find different ways of controlling them. And this is when you get the rise of fascism. This is when you get some horrible years in the centre of the 20th century.
One of the things that comes out of that, sort of post the Second World War, I guess, but sort of during it as well, I mean, we can talk about philosophers such as Jean-Paul Sartre, and in the book you start off that discussion of sort of nihilism, existentialism, with, I guess, another philosopher, Rick Blaine.
Oh, mighty Rick Blaine. Yes, Casablanca. Yeah, I love Casablanca.
Me too.
I love all Hollywood films from the 1940s. It's just, I don't know, there's none of the sentimentality you get after. and none of the sort of tweeness you get before the 1940s. People had been through World War II. You know, there was a certain honesty and directness about those films in the 1940s. They're just wonderful. And this was the period where the centre of innovation in the world, which had been the first half of the 20th century, Germany, definitely Germany, and German-speaking Europe, you know, Vienna, Switzerland, Austria, that was where all ideas were coming from, you know. That's where you get Einstein, that's where you get Freud, this is quantum mechanics, this was the real hotbed of innovation. But then came the cancer of fascism when it was over, and that's when America starts to become it becomes the American century. That's kind of what I'm trying to say. America takes over then. America's leading the way we develop. And Casablanca is an interesting film because Rick Blaine, he's an isolated anti-hero. You get a lot of these anti-heroes suddenly arriving at the first time. You know, he sticks his neck out for no one. You know, he drinks alone. He's obviously a very romanticised anti-hero in that you just want to, you know, he's so cool. You think he's so cool, despite how damaged and he is. But he's an example of that sort of logical conclusion of the rise of the individual in the first half of the 20th century. The beat writers were a similar sort of thing. That isolated, lonely person with nothing to believe in, this is where you get the rise of existentialism. Yeah. This is where you get the sense that life is meaningless. See, it was sort of a logical conclusion from being cut off from everything else. You get this sort of dark period. And it was especially notable after the Second World War, because at the end of the war, everyone was so relieved and they just wanted to go back to how things had been. But, you know, how had things been? You know, the period between the wars had been so tumultuous and full of change that we hadn't really come to terms with what we'd discovered about ourselves, hadn't really come to terms with what it meant to live in a society that understood that officers were arbitrary and they were all isolated and separate from each other. And it was only at the end of the Second World War that people started to deal with that, and hence you get Jean-Paul Sartre and Nausea and all those sort of things that can seem a bit navel-gazing to the modern eye, I think, to the modern ear.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
And also a bit bleak, I guess. So perhaps let's sort of...
Very, very bleak. Yes.
So brighten that up a bit as well, because the other thing that comes out of the Second World War, specifically the end of the Second World War, but has obviously been growing before that, is a sort of concept of, I guess, universal human rights that later in the 20th century we'll see the sort of advances in, you know, sort of anti-racism and sexual politics and things. But I mean, let's talk about, we'll talk about sex and your chapter on sex, which basically charts the sort of changing attitudes to sex in both, you know, society and literature over the course of the 20th century, and sort of starts with a sort of interesting character, Mary Stopes, who I think is a good example of the sort of contradictions that our attitudes to sex have changed over the years.
She's one of those remarkable figures, is Mary Stopes. You get one about every 50 years or so who'll come along and sort of open up a whole new territory in the centre of our culture that nobody sort of acknowledged before and be briefly lionised for it. But at that point, start to become toxic because of a sort of messianic personality. The sort of personality that could produce this new territory in our culture is often difficult and troublesome. So, and then 50 years later, you've got Timothy Leary, who did a similar sort of thing, and then 50 years later, you get Julian Assange. And people like Julian Assange, we'll talk warmly about someone like Snowden.
Yeah.
People will be very positive about Snowden, but won't stand by Assange. But it's Assange's personality that opened up that sort of territory in the first place that Snowden could come into. And Mary Stopes was the same with contraception, with the idea that sex without purpose of procreation was of value. You know, she was the one who put that front and centre in our society. It takes a very driven personality to do that. It's not the sort of thing that anyone can do. Obvious afterwards, it seems utterly, you know, unarguable, but beforehand it was just such a scandalous and unacceptable position. So, a very interesting character, Mary Stopes. Yeah, I mean, we now know her as just a horrible racist, basically. But without her, the acceptance of contraception would not have happened at that point. You know, it did need... There was a lot of people fighting for it and arguing for it, but sometimes you need a shit kicker, mm-hmm. essentially, a real shit kicker to come along and just kick something right into our culture, which is what she did.
And as I said, the parallel with the changing attitudes to sex in society, which leads, you know, from obviously Mary Stokes first introducing that idea of mass contraception right up to the 60s and the introduction of the contraceptive pill, and now that sort of parallels the rise of individualism again, and, you know, that turns out to be, again, a lot darker history, really, than I think the sort of idealism of the 60s would have thought.
Yes, I think so.
But sort of paralleling that in the book, you talk about the changing attitudes to sex in literature as well, mentioning people like, you know, sort of D.H. Lawrence. So those two things are obviously... I mean, I guess they pull each other along, don't they, as the changing attitudes of society. And
they certainly go hand in hand. But, I mean, you're right about it being much darker than the simple idea of just a freeing up of sexual liberation would suggest. I think the song Rape by Peter Wingard sums this up probably better than anything else. It was 1971, maybe, give or take a year. Something like Peter Wingard was a huge star, right? He was Jason King, the spy in the series. He's the guy Austin Powers is based on, more or less. But a real major celebrity. He had a major label record, a major record label giving him, signing him up, getting him to do an album and things like this. So this was, you know, front and centre in our culture. And on it, he does this song, Rape, which is about the different pleasures of raping people from different ethnicities, which he talks about in his suave, spy-like way over this sort of easy-listening 70s music. And women screaming in the background. And this thing exists. And people, everyone involved must have thought, well, that's okay. You know, that this is, as I say, made, it wasn't just in the obscure corner of culture. Mm-hmm. This was a big star on a major label. And just go to YouTube and look up Peter Wingard Rape. It'll just give you the, for what for me is the sort of ultimate expression of that weird combination of the understanding ourselves of individuals, like not thinking about thinking about ourselves first, which does not lend itself to thinking about consent or about losing the your individual ego and this freeing up of sexual liberation with the pill and the change in society at all. It just got really, really odd, really dark. And, you know, 70s TV is fairly unbroadcastable now due to the, you know, women only existing, you know, to scream and be chased and to take their clothes off and, you know, that whole Benny Hill thing and things like that. That was just considered normal. It's bizarre.
I think it's only really recently that we've started to look back on that period as that, you know, the idea that the pill, like women's sexuality has always been something that's been difficult to acknowledge, never mind sort of discuss, but the idea of the pill as being something that would sexually liberate women, but only if it was for men, really.
Yeah, I mean, it was... At the time, I mean, we think of the 60s as a form of, as that great period of liberation across culture, really, because of, you know, what it did for civil rights, gay rights, environmentalism, vegetarian, all these movements we associate with the 60s. And I think because of that, there's a tendency to see feminism as part of the 60s. But it's striking that isn't the case. It really is the 70s. It really is afterwards that the women's lib movement becomes quite so central to culture as it became with the likes of Germaine Greer and things like that. And obviously, there were predecessors. I talk a lot about Betty Friedan in the book and things like that. But it was the 70s women's lib movement was in many ways a reaction to how awful things had got for the way women who were just sort of viewed as objects. It's that Grateful Dead song, Jack Straw. We can share the women, we can share the wine. There's this notion of women as objects, or that
Mungo Jerry.
In the summertime. Yes, in the summertime, that great drink driving song. Yes, of course, how could I forget? If her daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If her daddy's poor, just do what you feel. You know, this being an individual, being a free individual, is what's cool. Mm-hmm. And all attempts to put constraints on your individual freedom are just frowned upon by society.
Men's individual freedom.
Men's individual. Yeah. It got very rapey. It got very... And you'll, and now, of course, we're seeing all the people who came up in... And not all the people, obviously, but, you know, obviously I'm thinking of Jimmy Savile. I'm thinking of a lot of the politicians of the 70s, certainly into the 80s. The sort of these institutionalised paedophile scandals, which are, you know, are still becoming clear, but there's a real sense that really consent was not a big, you know, was not what people was about. It was just this focus on the individual, focus on yourself, doesn't lend yourself to concern about the other person, which is not what sex is about. I mean, it certainly wasn't what Mary Stopes viewed sex as about. It certainly wasn't what D.H. Lawrence viewed sex was about. They all wrote about the importance of sex as a form of a complete spiritual union, being necessary to being a complete happy person. It's just giving yourself totally to someone, losing yourself, that loss of ego, that, you know, the biblical phrase is to know someone. It's not about just you. It's about that, as the Spice Girls so beautifully put it, when two become one, to quote the Spice Girls. That wasn't what the sexual liberation of the 60s was about at all.
No, it's amazing how sweet that sounds, you know, considering how things did end up, the direction they took. The idea that there was, you know, such opposition to somebody like D.H. Lawrence does seem like really... really quaint now.
But it's a lot of a class thing, I think, I think D.H. Lawrence. I think people said, oh, it's just, it's so rude, it's terrible. But what he really understood was that the class system was effectively, you know, the upper class were effectively zombies after World War One. You know, they still existed, they were there, they shuffled around and moved, but they were dead, you know, they were totally dead. And his Lord Chatterley has been made impotent by some attack in the war. He's in a wheelchair, he can't carry on his name. You know, he summed up the impotence and the end, basically, of the upper classes in England as anything other than a sort of historical curio. I think that's what was really shocking about Lady Chatterley.
Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. I'm talking to John Higgs, and we're talking about his book Stranger Than We Can Imagine, Making Sense of the 20th Century. And John, to finish it off then, let's, I guess, bring us up to towards the end of the 20th century and some of the, you know, the movements and conditions that are still affecting us today. But to start that off with, you talk in the book about a movement in mathematics, chaos.
Chaos, yes. A lot of what happened in the second half of the 20th century. We've been talking about individualism. And when I started writing this book, I just thought, well, I know what the story is. It's the rise of the individual. And that seems self-evident. So I start writing it, and it was, you know, not an easy book to write, as I'm sure you can guess. And it was only about, I mean, I took five drafts, but it was only about halfway through the third draft that I suddenly realised that wasn't the story of the 20th century. After all, that was certainly the story of the first half of the 20th century. And it appears to be the story of all the 20th century, because individualism becomes so embedded in our politics. It becomes the standard political viewpoint, certainly from Thatcher onwards. The idea of the individual with their own personal aspirations is how you understand politics, and there's no such thing as society.
And that's the rise of neoliberalism.
Neoliberalism, and certainly all New Labour, it was so entrenched. But politics is way behind everything else. Everything else was going, wow, individualism really is troublesome and doesn't actually make a huge amount of sense. It's so full of contradictions. You cannot understand the world if you just view it as individuals. And I'm talking, be that emotionally, biologically, culturally, socially, in any of these forms. We now have to look at, you know, you can't understand something by itself. You have to look at it in context. That's all of what the 20th century was about. Certainly chaos mathematics was a big part of that. So it became a real surprise to me that the book wasn't just the story of the rise of individualism. It was just this individualism was this period, this sort of liminal period between this hierarchical system ending suddenly and where we are now in this networked world. It was this brief period in between when the old rules had ended, but the new hadn't started yet. So it was sort of wild and free and anything goes, and violent and crazy and exciting and things like that. But it's only really politics that keeps this notion of the individual alive. I like to view it from the point when Apollo 8 rounded the moon, and you know they'd gone to the moon. It was the greatest achievement in human history, the Apollo program, in my personal opinion. And they got round, and all of a sudden they went, "Oh God, look at that!" And there was the just hanging there, this beautiful blue dot. And no one had gone to the moon expecting to turn around and see the Earth. And but this is what they all talk about. You know, they don't talk. You know, the moon. Okay, it was interesting if you like rocks. But to understand the Earth as a self-contained, coherent biosphere, as we do now, was a big, big change in the way we understood the world. Previously, the world was a horizon. Mm-hmm. You know, somewhere like America was a frontier. It was there for us to sort of look after and enrich ourselves from and things like that. But suddenly it was finite. We were suddenly in this finite system and everything was codependent on everything else. And this is what you see in what was new and what we learnt in the 20th century. And chaos mathematics is a good example of that. Certainly things like environmentalism are sort of very much keyed into that and the rise of the internet and so forth.
So we started off not long into the discussion talking about modernism, the rise of modernism, art movement. It's a not particularly nowadays from the vantage point of the 21st century great named movement.
Yeah, it's quite kind
it's
of
over
funny.
100 years old.
Yeah.
But we all sort of recognise modernism when we see it, I guess. And let's talk about, playfully I'll say, what comes after modernism, which is something that nobody understands.
Well, it's such a bad name, and it's not as bad though as Generation Y. You know, we had the baby boomers, and had Generation X, of which I am part of, and that sort of made sense. Generation X, it was sort of a questioning sort of thing, and then it was, well, what comes after Generation X? Generation Y? You know, there was nothing about the name that described what was happening. And postmodernism was again a similar thing, but it was such a broad word for such a broad spread of ideas. It essentially, I think it described where we were in the second half of the 20th century really well. Mm. But I know that postmodernism as a word has become such an insult, such a hated thing that you can just go, you can just call something postmodern and dismiss it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with the history of academia and postmodernism, which was a very tempestuous relationship, not a wise one, didn't end well. I talk in the book about the Sokol hoax, in which a totally spoofed paper was submitted to a postmodern journal called Social Text, which basically said that, the rules of physics can be anything we want them to be, because that's, you know, that was a nice postmodern idea. And the people who run the journal didn't sort of notice that it was spoofing them, and they just ran it. And instead of this being seen as an attack on the editorial boards of academic journals, which would make a lot of sense, it became seen as a killer blow to postmodernism itself, because postmodernism sort of, I don't know, I guess you could say it sort of denies any exterior framework to make sense of it, which is the opposite of academia, which academia is an external framework to make sense of all our knowledge. So things, I would say, are fundamentally are incompatible. But beyond academia, beyond all these, you know, meaningless papers, pretty much all our culture, or a large part of it, was what would be called postmodern, from cartoons like Danger Mouse that were self-aware, an awful lot of comedy, Monty Python, video games, certainly, a lot of music, I'm thinking New Order, pop videos, you know, all the ideas of postmodernism, the idea that you don't need an external framework to justify what you're doing. You can mash together whatever you like. You're not concerned about it being highbrow, you're not concerned about it being lowbrow. You're just whacking weird stuff together and seeing what you get. That was everywhere. That was throughout society.
Yeah.
And so I think those who just dismiss, or the idea that postmodern is something we just have to go, that was a mistake. Yeah. What? I don't believe it was a mistake at all. That sort of dismisses all the steps that took us there, all the gradual understanding that certain frameworks are arbitrary, that certain viewpoints were not in any way sort of favoured. It doesn't necessarily mean that anything goes.
Yeah.
You still have to be practical about these things. But
I've got sort of two points to add to that, really. And first of all, obviously one of the key tenets of postmodernism is, jouissance, the sort of sense of playfulness,
yeah,
shall we say. And very much in that sense, can I say that, one of the key tenets of postmodernism is surely the idea that there are no fixed viewpoints.
Yeah, definitely.
And, it's all dependent on the observer, which is the central argument of this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Postmodernism is so key to the 20th century that just because it's got a terrible name and just because a lot of crap was written in academia, we can't dismiss it. We can't dismiss it. I mean, for the postmodernist chapter, when I was approaching it, I was thinking, oh dear God, this isn't going to go well. I've got to write a chapter on postmodernism. I'm hell's teeth. How am I going to do that? Essentially, as you'll know, you've seen the book, the chapter basically uses Super Mario Brothers as the way to explain postmodernism. And I think that's much more in keeping with how we should understand it than academic, squabbles. Yes.
Which you then deconstruct that and discuss how that was a very postmodern thing to do and everything.
Yeah.
You start off the chapter with the classic I happen to have Marshall McLuhan right here, seen from Annie Hall.
Ah, that's great. Yes.
Greatest films of all time as well, in my opinion. the second point I was going to make was that I think although this sort of period of time would be post that sort of classic Foucault-esque sort of like academic postmodernist period, but I think it also absolutely sums up that weird post-Berlin Wall, pre-9/11 end of history period.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There was that sort of very weird that period. Obviously, the rise of neoliberalism as well, but that sort of when we absolutely without any sort of sense of irony said, capitalism has won, history is over. That sounds like a very postmodern thing to me as well.
Well, yes. I mean, that was very much tied up in the whole neoliberal worldview. the notion that the individual, as the only way to understand ourselves, was the end point of, previously we'd had that, as I say, that know your place thing, but we'd evolved out of that, and now we saw ourselves as free individuals. And the fallacy at the heart of Thatcherism, New Labour, was that was the end point of how we would come to see ourselves. Right? That we weren't continually evolving, that was it. That's not it at all. There's a real sort of dividing line. I think how you react to selfies is the best example to show which sort of side of you're on. If, like me, I was born in 1971, I'm a product of the 20th century, of the glorification of individualism. You see somebody holding a phone up in front of their face and taking a picture of themselves. The temptation is to see that as a person vainly photographing themselves to see themselves. But to someone from the millennial generation, they don't see it in those terms in the slightest. They see it in, the photo only exists to sort of strengthen social bonds. That cannot be seen, if you're just thinking of one person, they're thinking of the whole group, of the whole network. It's somebody winking at all their friends. It doesn't make sense in isolation. It only makes sense in the wider picture. And which one of those you are, I think, is very, very telling. And even now, at the moment, we've got the Labour leader elections is coming up in a couple of weeks. And the position of all the Blairites is a blind panic, right, and horror of the rise of Jeremy Corbyn. I don't know when this will go out, but at the moment that's the position. And what they seem to be saying when all these young people are flocking to Jeremy Corbyn is that it's some horrible throwback, right? As if the generation of digitally connected 21st century internet-enabled people are looking at the world and saying, well, we should really just be like, you know, a union leader from Carry On Up at Your Convenience or something
like
that.
People probably can't even really remember Margaret Thatcher being in power.
That's really not what they're doing. You know, they really are seeing the world in a fundamentally different way to how the Blairites are. Mm-hmm. And the Blairites are the throwback now. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously there's demographic and generational shifts and things like that, so it takes a while to... It takes many decades for these things to work themselves through the system. But it is the case of politicians just not grasping the changes that have occurred in the generation below them.
I'm Ian Sinclair. Go and read some great new journalism and explore the interview archive at littleatoms.com.
One more point then, just to finish off, and I guess we'll sort of cheat and extend the 20th century up to where we are now.
That's what really, I did.
For the sake of this point. You know, you mentioned earlier on in the interview the influence of people like Timothy Leary on Silicon Valley. Mm. But also, there's a romantic image of Silicon Valley as being like a sort of 1960s egalitarian thing. But of course, they've all got their Ayn Rand books on their shelves. It's an incredibly individualistic neoliberal place as well. And I think that's sort of shown in that, in the sort of contradiction of, we are now a network culture. The internet has made us. The society we live in now is sort of... That, I think that's the big thing that was unrecognisable to... You talk earlier in the book about people like H.G. Wells cleverly prophesying some of the things that would happen in the future. And the thing that has never really been sort of visualised, I think, is the way that the internet has connected everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's a network, a socialist network of individuals, individualistic people. Yes, we are all individuals, you know, that's...
Yeah, we have become a planet of individuals, mm-hmm. You know, that's what... There's a big contrast in a contradiction in the heart of the computer culture. And a lot of it came up from this hippie psychedelic era, early online communities such as The Well. It's very much obvious you see it in things like the open source movement, mm-hmm. Things like Wikipedia, this egalitarian coming together of contributing, combined with this sort of rabid, sort of monopolistic business culture of the startups and but it has changed our world so radically, just this connecting up of everyone. Because essentially, I was talking earlier about at the start of the 20th century, we were still this hierarchy with emperors at the top. It was like, if you imagine human beings are like points of light, they were all connected up in this a vertical hierarchy to our lord and master at the top. That ended at World War One, and now it's like all those links just shattered, and we became these free floating points of light, trying to make sense of our lives from that perspective. And we got freedom, you know, and we got the ability to go in the directions we wanted, to become the people we wanted, and that was very, very valuable. And we sort of wanted freedom without responsibility. But this feedback loop being introduced into our culture from Silicon Valley, from the internet, and suddenly we're all connecting up to each other again. So we've become this sort of this network, and information flows differently through a network than it does a hierarchy. And as a result, this wave of transparency has just washed across all our institutions, all our cultures, everything from MPs' expenses to, you know, the Vatican paedophile stuff, to FIFA, to the LIBOR rate rigging, to South Yorkshire Police. There's just scandal after scandal after scandal, because when we just had hierarchical institutions, the way information flowed around meant that corruption could build in, can build up, and it became normalised. You know, MPs' expenses were just normal, it was just what people did. But when information flows in a different way, suddenly it seemed to be not normal. You know, suddenly we have all the corruptions of the past, you know, how many decades are all coming to light at once. And it just seems a bit terrifying. It just seems that we just live in the most horrible world on some levels. In the 20th century, the fact that Nixon was linked to Watergate, the Watergate burglary, was such a huge scandal that it took, you know, the American legal system and the American press, you know, years to work through. Now that little scandal seems trivial. You know, so many more just jaw-droppingly awful embedded corruptions coming to light, because this wave of transparency is just swashing around our entire culture. Because it's so new, it's quite traumatic. But I kind of think in the long run it's got to be a positive thing. It has to be a positive thing to be sort of washing away all this. And we're suddenly confronted with how everyone else thinks. You know, you go on Twitter and it can be quite disturbing and appalling to just see all this bitterness and this trolls and this nastiness. And there was John Ronson wrote that fantastic book, and it's only been publicly shamed, that sort of looks at people who've just done a stupid thing and had their lives destroyed because of it. Because previously, you know, I mean, a good example is the woman who put the cat in the bin. You know the cat bin woman? She'd done that 5-10 years earlier. She'd have just put the cat in the bin and gone about her business and nothing would have happened, right? But now, you do something like that and there's consequences to your actions. And the consequences in that case are being considered one of the most evil people in the world by many hundreds of thousands of people, and losing your job and having your life destroyed. It's a real change. And it can seem grim, you know, it can seem frightening, but at the same time, the notion that if we accept that we're responsible for our actions and what we say, and that if, you know, we say something that causes a lot of upset to a lot of people, we will hear about it, kind of thing, that's got to be a positive thing in the long run. Once we get used to this transparency, once we get used to the way information flows around this new networked world, it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be this grim forever, I think.
That's the takeaway point then that we can stop on. So I've been talking about Stranger Than We Can Imagine, Making Sense of the 20th Century by John Higgs. And it's published by Wedenfeld and Nicholson on the 27th of August. John, thank you very much for telling me about it.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.